Yao Graham est originaire du Ghana. Il est le coordinateur de Third World Network Afrique, une organisation panafricaine de recherche et de plaidoyer qui est basée à Accra, au Ghana. Yao a étudié le droit à l'Université du Ghana, à l'Université libre de Bruxelles et à l'Université Warwick, où il a obtenu son doctorat. Il a publié de nombreux articles sur les problématiques de développement de l'Afrique. Il est le rédacteur en chef de la Review of African Political Economy et aussi membre du groupe international d'études mis sur pied par la Commission économique pour l'Afrique afin de produire un rapport sur les régimes miniers en Afrique. Donc, Yao va nous parler de l'expérience africaine et du travail de Third World Network.
Good evening to all of you, and let me express my thanks and appreciation to InterParis and the League for making this meeting possible and for me to participate in this evening. The first presentation raises many of the same things that we are working on, you know, in an African context. Questions of environmental and social impacts of mining are common, and the issues of human rights are common, and they have been very much part of the definition of the work of my organization, Third World Network, and its associates in Africa and outside. Third World Network has been working on mining issues for more than 10 years. We work actively with groups in Ghana, where we are based. There's a national coalition called the National Coalition on Mining, which brings together community groups, NGOs who are working on mining issues from a variety of entry points: human rights, taxation, transparency, health, environmental issues, legal aid. All of them are part of the coalition. And this diversity is a real sort of strength because it allows all the multifaceted issues which are raised by mining to be approached, and also different skill sets are brought to bear, and therefore as a collective, we all the much the better for it. But the situation in Ghana, it's typical of what is happening in many African countries. Ghana, the main export mineral is gold. I've said many times that gold is the most sought after mineral, but it's probably the one which is of least practical value. And yet is the one which the price of which keeps climbing and climbing and climbing, you know. But around the continent, the situation we find of the widespread growth of mining and the community impacts are very common. And it's important also to situate this development in a wider historical context so as to kind of appreciate what really we are dealing with. The search for control of mineral resources, of course, was a key driver of colonialism and the partition of Africa. And therefore, in the post-colonial period, control over mineral resources became a very important symbol of what independence was about. So that at the national level, virtually all African countries nationalized mineral resources. It was a major statement that colonialism had ended. At the international level, African countries were in the forefront of the adoption of resolutions at the United Nations on the permanent sovereignty of states over natural resources, and also about the right to development, all as an assertion of the right of people to make their own development choices and to control the resources which will make that possible. It's important also to recognize that at the international level, those things were framed in the language of rights. Framed in the language of rights, not as individual rights, but as the language of collective rights. Because this permanent sovereignty formulation really was about a collective ownership and a collective entitlement, and therefore a collective benefit from those resources. And the same, of course, of the right to development, which was also a statement about the fact that the legacy of colonialism was widespread underdevelopment. and therefore the rights of people to development was not simply to assert, you know, an equality to the same standards of living, but also to be able to make the to make this choice collectively so that everybody can benefit. So that when you look at this history, what came to pass from the late 1980s, when under structural adjustment, African countries dissolved their state-owned enterprises, privatized the mineral resources, and gave them to transnational corporations. That was a huge backward step in terms of the hopes of development of independence. But of course, there's a paradox here, because at the same time as these assets were being denationalized and privatized and handed back, in many cases, to the successor corporations which have been dominant in the colonial period, this was also the same time that a political liberalization was taking place across the continent, which was celebrated by citizens. Because it's also true that by the 1980s, the post-colonial expectations of economic advancement was in crisis. And it was also true that many post-colonial governments have been authoritarian and they have failed to deliver on the expectations which have been the basis of all the things about nationalization and also the assertions which have been made at the international level. So the political liberalization gave people, gave constitutional form to people's yearning for greater recognition of individual rights. So that across the continent, all national constitutions today have strong human rights frameworks. And I think those human rights frameworks are important for our analysis, therefore, of what is happening in the mining sector. But those human rights frameworks also have to be taken side by side with the fact that the traditions which are embodied by the old UN declarations about permanent sovereignty and the right development are no less important today, simply because other things have become important. Because the underdevelopment which drove those resolutions still persist in Africa. And therefore, in that context, one has to say that in terms of any project to develop natural resources, they must fulfill the expectations of peoples that the exploitation of these resources, although now handed over for private development, were still public assets. So the Ghanaian constitution, for example, contains a principle that mineral resources are owned by the state in trust for the people. And one of the things being discussed in South Africa today as part of the post-colonial, post-apartheid project is whether or not to nationalize minerals as part of the project of, you know, kind of a rolling back apartheid. What has happened, however, since the 1990s has been a situation where really a huge gulf has opened between the formal legal situation of public ownership and the de facto control and ownership of these resources by the companies who have been granted concessions. Because as part of the structural adjustment disposition, the World Bank and bilateral bodies like CEDA oversaw the passage of mining legislation, which gave extremely generous terms to foreign investors. Across the continent, you have a situation where, on average, the royalty rates which are paid by companies, it's about 3%. In an extreme case like that of Zambia, the royalty rate is 0.6%. So that when you compare what actually is happening now in terms of even the financial returns to countries, things are very extreme. Let's take one example from Zambia. In 1992, when Zambia exported about 400,000 tons of copper, and copper makes up about 80% of Zambia's exports, at a price of about $2,800 a ton. And this was done by the state's the parastatal mining company, ZCCM. The revenue to the Zambian government from taxes, not export earnings, from taxes, was about $200 million. In 2004, now that the mineral is in the privatized hands of transnational corporations, same quantity of copper, roughly the same price, the revenue to the Zambian government was $8 million. So this is what we are dealing with. So even Ghana, which is the second largest exporter of gold in Africa after South Africa, with a 3% royalty rate, with gold going through the roof in terms of prices, in 2007, for more than $2 billion worth of gold exports, Ghana got less than $100 million as royalty. Okay. In addition, in many countries, the companies have a framework which allows them very extensive exemptions. In some cases, they don't pay company the corporate tax for 10 years. They don't pay any tax on goods and services. And also, many of them have set up shell companies in tax havens, which they use to manipulate, you know, their tax base, and also to manipulate the tax of mineral exports. One of the companies which is involved in controversy in Zambia at the moment, for example, is the Canadian firm First Quantum. Because First Quantum has a shell company in the British Virgin Islands. Together with its joint venture partner, Glencore, they both have shell companies, which are the majority owners in the Zambian copper mining company, Mopani Holdings. And the price at which copper is sold by Mopani to the shell companies is below the international price. And copper is one mineral which the price of which has gone up tremendously. Between 2002 and 2008, the price of copper went up four times. And the profits of firms like First Quantum went through the ceiling. Now, so this boom in profitability with the global mining boom since around 2000, there's a slight blip around the time of the global crisis, but by and large, it has continued, you know, a steady kind of climb. So companies really have been raking it in. They've been raking it in on a massive scale. In fact, in the 6 years up to 2008, the cumulative profits, average profits of the top mining companies was 1,900% within 6 years. That's how much their profits climbed. And of course, nothing near this figure has been distributed to the countries, you know, which own the minerals. So we are talking really about finite, non-renewable natural resources, which are being taken out. Owning countries are not getting enough of a share. And of course, the development needs of these countries are very huge. What has been dominant in international discourse has been a focus on transparency, revenue transparency. Now, transparency is extremely important because all of us citizens are entitled to know how public finances are being managed and how the overall business of government is being run, not only around mineral revenues, all aspects of government. So it's extremely important. But it is a curious focus on transparency because of the angle that it comes from. Certainly, all of us have been able to know one thing. Transparency has allowed confirmation of one thing that some of us have argued all the time, that the revenue is derisory. And transparency at least allows us to confirm that what people get is not enough and that more is needed. Now, more is needed because what we've also seen is that at the level of the communities where the minerals are exploited, the generous frameworks that the companies have been allowed extend also to fairly low enforcement of standards, environmental standards, the protection of human rights, and many other things. It's quite routine for the human rights of communities in mining areas to be violated. The mechanisms for the environmental and social impact assessment does not give enough protection to communities. You have a context where rights consciousness is not very strong. And the promise of development in poor communities is a very alluring kind of appearance. So people believe that if some investments come, benefits will be shared. But the experience in general has been one of disappointment. And that disappointment also, I think, puts in perspective really the limits of the growing belief, including in Canada, that corporate social responsibility of a voluntary type is the answer to the development challenge, you know, in mining communities. Because the companies would do a minimum so as to gain the social license to operate. And if you look also at the proportion of company expenditure all over the world that goes into CSR activity, it's extremely minute. In fact, somebody has remarked, and I'm inclined to agree with him, that we need to see expenditure, we need to see corporate social responsibility really as similar to the social safety nets which have accompanied the spread of neoliberal economics. So that as more people drop through the bottom, as the bottom opens and more people are kind of expelled and marginalized, some minimum mechanisms are needed to kind of clean up so as not to have a social crisis. So that really, CSR, it's akin to kind of poverty reduction strategies, when really the problem is that the model itself has an inbuilt tendency to marginalize more people and to kick out more people. So we believe that really the starting point must be a focus for greater corporate accountability. Greater corporate accountability around a number of issues. First and foremost, the framework within which the companies invest must guarantee an adequate return from the exploitation of minerals. That adequate return will strengthen the fiscal capacity of states to provide for development. If developing countries have a greater fiscal capacity from their own resources to develop, they'll be less dependent on aid and facing a situation where a very small percentage of public revenues coming from aid usually leads to a disproportionate influence by donors over countries' choices. So greater fiscal capacity is also greater autonomy over development choices. So it's not simply a financial outcome, but it's also a political, a critical political consequence, you know, from those things. Of course, that greater availability also, even though we cannot guarantee that the allocation of resources will be democratic, it certainly increases the quantum of resources around which citizens can struggle for more democratic allocation. Now, this is an important issue because governments point to the concessions they give to companies as reason why they expect CSR investment. Companies point to what the small taxes they pay as justification for why nobody should have expectations of them, because they are doing their best as corporate citizens. So it becomes a game of musical chairs. And caught in the middle, really, are those who are most severely impacted, you know, by mining. To get progress on this, it seems to me that a number of things have to happen. One, frameworks, as I said, have to change. And a key part of that is that African governments must raise the royalty rates that they charge. They must have frameworks to be able to impose windfall taxes. So that the situation that we've had where profits have gone through the roof and only a very small proportion goes to the mineral-owning countries must come to an end. At the height of the price boom before the crisis, a number of countries tried to impose windfall taxes. But the onerous terms of the concessions they had granted became clear, because the companies pointed to the long-term stability clauses which allow their taxes to be frozen, 20 years and so on and so forth, as reason why it would be a breach of contract for the governments to try to exercise their sovereign right to raise taxes. People have asked questions whether, in fact, those stability clauses are not unconstitutional, because you cannot bind the future discretion of Parliament on a fundamental issue like taxes. There are a number of areas where existing free trade agreements, bilateral investment treaties, and so on, also constrain the freedom of countries to make choices. These are areas where I think it's important for citizens campaigning to bring attention so that in the negotiations that our governments, you know, engage in, we get some things changed. There are many allowances that companies are allowed, which many of us think should be scrapped, because they really are not beneficial. Over the past 20 years, there has been a destructive race to the bottom among African countries to compete for investment. The result really is that the only beneficiaries are the companies. Increasingly, African countries are recognizing that they need to cooperate rather than to compete, you know, among themselves. One of the effects of the price boom is that countries are beginning to see that the old paradigm has to shift. And in 2009, African governments adopted an African mining vision, which contains many possibilities. But I hasten to add that it is a framework. It is not yet a policy shift. It will take a lot of work for that policy shift to happen, because there are vested interests in the model which exists now. There are vested interests in the existing practice, not simply on the side of the companies and their home governments, but also because in African countries, they are beneficiaries from the model. So to get that shift, it will be important for campaigning to continue. And the combination of activism within African countries and international solidarity, which has been important for some of those shifts, you know, need to continue. In the work that we do as Third World Network, part of our work very crucially has been involved in mobilizing mining communities in mining areas. We have used a number of modalities for this. In Ghana, for example, 3 years ago, we got the Human Rights and Administrative Justice, SRAJ, to carry out an investigation about human rights violations in mining areas. And they came out with a ringing endorsement of all the allegations that have been made. There's a 200-plus page report, which it's a major kind of institutional endorsement of the demands that NGOs have been making. 2 years ago, the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, also after years of lobbying by groups including Third World Network, agreed to set up a working party to look at environmental and human rights questions in the mining sector, so that we are beginning to see a movement beyond the national level, beyond the community level, around these rights questions. One of our own hopes is that at some point, something similar to the Aarhus Convention that Marie-Jose was using to illustrate a point could become part of the human rights framework in the African continent. That would be an important development. But in the meantime, some of the initiatives that countries are undertaking to at least improve the framework for benefit sharing is quite important. But also, the human rights initiatives at national and Africa-wide levels are also important, because they strengthen the self-belief and the capacity of people to be able to stand, that even that the notion of common ownership of natural resources cannot simply remain formal, but that in the ways in which they are exploited, their rights must be respected. In the ways in which the revenue is distributed, there must be equal access, so that the notion of ownership, the right, the sovereignty of a natural resource, and the right to development is actually not simply a formal declaration, but actually a substantive experience, you know, of peoples. So these are some of the pressing issues that we've been working on, and these are issues which we think represent a good agenda for work going forward. Thank you very much.